Talkers.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 28. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey, and my guest this episode is Liam Wilson. Liam is best known as the longtime bass player for the band The Dillinger Escape Plan. He's been featured on the cover of Bass Player magazine. In more recent years, he's also performed live with the Norwegian black metal act Mirker, Canadian musician and producer Devin Townsend. He's part of Azusa, a supergroup of sorts with members of Extol and CNR, and the mastermind behind the band John Frum, a conceptually driven, psychedelic, progressive death metal band. He is also one of my favorite people in the world and a fascinating individual. He is more or less the archetype for this podcast and the whole concept behind this podcast, as you'll hear me explain to him when we get started with this conversation, which is hopefully going to be the first of many conversations with Liam on No Prize from God. He's the first person who ever said ayahuasca to me in conversation. He's been into yoga longer than just about anybody else that I know. Transcendental meditation, longtime vegan, but really just a very open-minded, inquisitive, seeker, spiritually centered kind of person. He's also a husband and a father, just an all-around amazing person. If memory serves, I believe the first time I met him, which was brief but memorable, was in Philadelphia at the Relapse record store. Just prior to him, I think he actually had joined Dillinger but had yet to perform live with them. As regular listeners to this podcast may know, I was at one time the manager for the Dillinger Escape Plan. But Liam and I were good friends before that, became even better friends during, and he remains, as I said, one of my absolute favorite people. If this is your first time listening to No Prize from God, or your gazillionth time listening to No Prize from God, the best thing you can do to support the podcast is to go into Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred platform is, leave a 5-star rating, and write a nice little review. I promise, those help. You can find No Prize from God on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. No Prize from God is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network, which includes Pop Curse, which is musicians talking movies, and Speak and Destroy, a podcast featuring interviews about Metallica. So here it is, my conversation with Liam Wilson. This is No Prize from God. Since coming up with the concept for this podcast, you might have been the first person I thought of, actually, about having on. You're definitely among the first two or three. And it's funny because I started the podcast a couple of years ago now at this point, but due to the sporadic nature of actually scheduling and getting episodes out, I think, you know, I'm less than 30 episodes in, but Getting better about it.
You were just getting warmed up.
It's still kind of funny to only just now be talking when, you very likely were the very first person that I thought about having on. This idea of conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. As you are one of the most creative people I know, and you have fascinating and unique viewpoints on a lot of this stuff that we talk about on this podcast. So with that in mind, tell me a little bit about how you were first introduced to concepts of life and death and meaning and what it's all about, and you know, faith and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic. Raised, it felt primarily by my mom's parents. My mom was once had understand, just kind of doing the lion's share of my probably 0 to 7 raising, which included like going to mass almost every day at the church up the street that I eventually went to grade school for a couple of years. And, you know, they weren't like, it wasn't like we were listening to Christian radio or anything like that. They weren't listening to lectures or, you know, it wasn't on that level, which I feel like you understand like tiers here, but they were devout, you know, and had their opinions about things. And for what it's worth, my mom came out as gay not long after I was born, which kind of then threw a lot of, that's kind of where the tracks started switching for me, or at least where I started having that, like, being able to zoom out and reflect my personal experience with, you know, the ancient wisdom or whatever, yeah, or whatever, you know, Vatican II says is church opinion things like homosexuality or such and such. So, you know, being, you know, born 79, so growing up, you know, and AIDS freakouts. So, you know, and the, you know, what we're kind of fully unpacking now with all the, you know, the Catholic molestation and abuse and all that kind of stuff too. So I think that was kind of the, still the beginnings of all of this. So I was, I guess all I'm trying to set up here is my grandparents were very, influential on me, had very faith-based opinions about the world, were very devout in their faith. But we always kind of had a very open dialogue, and especially when I started to recognize where my mom's lifestyle fit into all of this and where it didn't. And then when my parents divorced, having like this different perspective of like going to church at my dad's house, going or not going to church when I was with my mom, and then going to church all the coalesced into me just being interested in theology and being in Catholic schools my whole life. I kind of heard all the stories, just going to mass enough to, you know, start to catch on to things a little bit, and to ask bigger questions. I'm not really sure where the bigger questions came from. I think that was just, that's just where my soul is at this time around, you know, wherever my, my Atma, you know, is trying to figure out, you know, I feel like I've always asked big questions. And then as it progressed into, I guess, high school, I was going to high school in the inner city. I was exposed to a lot more of like the grit of a place like Philadelphia, which has a lot of grit. And, you know, I wasn't exposed to meditation, you know, the way I would have been had I grown up in maybe India or something. I'm not saying that everybody, not trying to stereotype, but, you know, those kind of things were still, you know, yoga was still like not quite a thing, mainstream thing on the East Coast yet. So I got into acid, you know, I got into psychedelics. That's kind of what my gateway to mystical experience was. And it didn't take long, you know, it was very quick. I got real shook, and but in a good way. I think, you know, it was, you know, things like Be a vegetarian, actually go vegan, was something that I realized while, you know, blasted out of my ego on mushrooms. And I think that those are the kind of things where I'm like, I don't think that, at least for me, the jury's not out on those things. I've kind of drifted and experimented at different times in my life with eating different things. And regardless of the health factor, I feel like on a spiritual level, I just kind of don't want to engage in it. Maybe it would make my brain better. I just don't really care. You know, I'm not so attached to my body that, you know, not to say I don't take care of it and do yoga, asana, you know, poses and stuff and try to be somewhat conscious of my health, but I don't know. Should I just keep ranting like this?
Is this how this works? This is beautiful. It kind of is. Well, I want to actually step back for a moment.
Okay.
Given that we're both Generation X, and as you mentioned, we came up in a time.
I'm a Xennial, proudly.
Sorry, I don't mean to age both of us.
No.
Okay. Okay, Boomer. Yeah. That's what the kids say, right?
Yep.
I would, you know, we, as you mentioned, you know, we were unpacking a lot of things, the AIDS crisis, you know, satanic panic on Phil Donahue.
Right, and, yeah, satanic panic. Fine.
You know, a bunch of stuff like that that was, yeah, you know, all interspersed, a lot of intersections. Yeah. What we were growing up around. Yeah, and it's crazy to think how controversial Sinead O'Connor ripping up a picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live was.
Oh, dude.
Even to a lot of progressive-leaning people, right?
Right, that were, yeah.
Still found it very offensive, and then to look back with the wisdom and hindsight of history about what she was specifically protesting is pretty unreal. And especially you and I, one of the things we have in common, both being of Irish Catholic descent.
Sure.
You know, having a...
Did I mention my mom was one of seven?
But when you mentioned Philadelphia, it actually makes me curious. Of course, you would have been, you know, 5 or 6 years old, but do you remember the MOVE bombing happening or being aware of that?
I certainly remember hearing about it. I couldn't tell you whether or not my earliest memories of hearing about it were contemporary with the event or not.
Mm-hmm.
I may have been a little young for that, but I certainly remember my dad openly discussing it. I think it took a long time before I fully understood or heard the story from like a Black or at least like activist perspective. Not saying my dad tainted it, but the viewpoint is different just because I think my dad is kind of apolitical in so many ways. So
He could be forgiven for not breaking down anarcho-primitivism to you.
Right. You know, yeah. And I think that some of those details that I would be interested in and maybe more empathetic to, you know, just are you know, flying over his head. But yeah, I do remember it. Why do you ask?
I was just curious. You know, the most recent guest I had on the podcast was an author named Adam Morris, who wrote a book called American Messiahs. And it's about a lot of these quote unquote cults throughout American history that actually had a lot of progressive ideas, including the ones that had these spectacular flameouts. And I don't mean MOVE,
right.
That would be a terrible pun. And that was a Waco style massacre by the state. But the ones that, you know, Jim Jones comes to mind, some of these people that had these radical beliefs and were in many cases abusive and terrible and megalomaniacal and all the things we already know about them. And yet were doing things like integrating their churches and, you know, stuff that were like multiple steps ahead of the wider culture. And when you talk about, you know, going to school in inner city Philadelphia, it reminds me that, you know, when I mentioned to this author that I grew up in Indiana, he was like, well, what was your, there's a whole big section about Jonestown in his book, and he's like, what was your recollection of, you know, what did you know about Jim Jones? And it's funny, much like you, of course, with MOVE, I didn't get any heavy duty context about what the whole thing was about,
but the first way
I heard about it was, believe it or not, when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out and was super popular, I would, I started to recognize that adults were snickering about a hero named Indiana Jones, because Jim Jones was often referred to as Indiana Jones around those parts.
I never thought of this.
And yeah, and so that's how I became aware of that whole thing, was my dad and people of his generation, you know.
Yeah, I mean, my dad certainly introduced me to MOVE. I think that that has a way deeper, it's more contextualized with what's happening currently.
Absolutely.
Then, at least for me, it's more about like my punk political beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And how that was just always part of my education growing up in a punk community here, progressive community here, and like protesting things and hearing about it from those points of view.
Yeah.
And like housing issues and stuff like that. So all that stuff to me was more of like that punk political sphere, and not so much like a belief. I don't feel like that had an influence on Philly or me in a belief state.
Sure.
I don't think it was ever looked at like a cult, or I don't feel like I ever heard of it really remarked about that way.
In terms of like a religious component to
it. Yeah, in terms of like a religious cult. Maybe it's just because Philly is so funky anyway, and we already have like the Amish and the, you know, like there's already so much funk here as far as belief, and maybe people in America take that for granted, but we have a lot of, we're very liberal as a commonwealth in terms of like, you know, everything from, you know, religious exemptions for vaccines, and it's kind of a wild west out here.
Yeah.
And I think always will be, because of those kind of, you're never just going to make a move that's going to take the Amish out of the picture. Yeah. And that kind of keeps Pennsylvania and this area positioned in a certain way, for better or for worse.
One of my favorite things about visiting Relapse Records for the first time, when it was still in the basement of a Santa Claus store adjacent to Amish country. And I just, that awesome juxtaposition of like, here's Christmas, here are the Amish, and here are these, you know,
like the
delinquents
Mennonite
blasting
thing,
death metal.
Right. The Mennonite thing definitely has a thing, not only in like food culture, but like, you know, even the mass that I would go to, there would be like what seemed to me like, I would assume almost like a Mennonite family or something on a fringe edge of Christianity, where they were like turbo Christian, but attending mass where I was, I don't know. Yeah. There's definitely a lot of that kind of stuff.
It's interesting.
Trickling down here.
So the psychedelics entered in where, as a teenager?
I'm going to say 14.
Oh, wow.
Youngish. 14, definitely like by 15.
Wow.
I'm going to say sophomore in high school.
And this question comes from an extremely non-judgmental point of view, because as you know, I'm certainly not anti.
Here.
Yeah.
And I'm not like turbo pro, like, go
acid. Sure. But my question there would be, you know, given what we know about our brains, right, and about, you know, how not developed they are until whatever age, do you think that's too young? Do you think it doesn't matter?
I think it's, I don't think you can make a blanket statement. I think it hit me at the right time, and I look at that as being like, oh God, you know, like, what would my life have been, or what? I definitely think that was where everything kind of, it made an upturn for me. I think I learned some things the hard way, but I think anybody who's well versed in psychedelics and still open to any of the other stuff we're discussing would probably agree, you know, and much, I mean, which is why things like MAPS organization, who are doing tons of work with PTSD and ecstasy and psilocybin and near-death experiences and all the other things that Michael Pollan writes about, and, you know, I don't know. Like I said, I wouldn't say that that's the best time to do it, but for me, it was, that's just kind of how it came. You know, it fell in my lap at that time. I didn't really go seek it out.
And so, did your initial interest in that because my experience, and this would be very much localized to being, you know, someone that was into horror movies and heavy metal and that sort of right. culture, you know, I heard about acid from like other metalheads, you know, so it didn't have like, when I think about psychedelics now as an adult, and I think more about primitivism and, you know, Eastern philosophy and, you know, any number of sort of spiritual connotations, hearing about acid for me as a teenager was very much just like a stoner, like, yeah, we're going to do some methamphetamines. We're going to smoke some weed.
I guess,
we're
going to take some acid. I mean, I guess it was coming from like the Grateful Dead-ish Fish side of things, which is, you know, I was already a musician at 12. So by 14, I'm still kind of exploring, like, you know, and trying to figure out my identity. What is it like to be a musician? What kind of musician do I want to be? Am I like Jimi Hendrix, Grateful Dead musician? Am I like King Crimson kind of musician? You know, what, you know, am I a hardcore musician? So I think my sister, my older sister's influence on me and her interest in that culture and like giving me Fish a picture of Nectar. And as a bass player, musician, just freaking out, like it's still to this day, I find that record pretty indisputably fierce musically. So, you know, I mean, the first time I did shrooms was at a Fish show, which is so stereotypical.
but almost sort of tender how stereotypical
and
it is.
Like,
you know what I mean? Like, that's cool.
In this day and age, that's like the rite of passage. That's like the Eleusinian mysteries or whatever it is for this.
Right.
You know, I don't know. Maybe that's a lofty way of thinking about it, but it's a rite of passage in a sense. Sure. And I think especially as a young man, you know, I'm not like, I don't have like a mensis to tell me I'm a man. I'm kind of trying to figure it out. I'm like, if I lose my virginity or like have a cool car or whatever, what is it? You know, if I play guitar in front of a bunch of people, am I going to feel, you know, my balls drop existentially? So yeah, I don't know. I mean, and then just, I think, and the other thing I have to say about the psychedelics is like, it always corroborated with my other thoughts and experiences. Like it didn't, I think at some points it eclipsed what I thought about religion. And then I kind of started tapping into this universalism or like, you know, my God is nature, you know, or my God is the universe or the energy or the force or something like that. It became very impersonal. And it also kind of became, you know, I think the more I did psychedelics, the more I kind of killed God and tried to reinvent myself as God in some way.
Yeah.
And then, you know, more so recently, I realized I've been humbled enough to just be like, I don't know shit about shit. And I'm certainly not God. And like, I might be able to name some stuff and science might be able to tell me why something measures the way it does or reacts this way. But like, and not to say it's not getting there rapidly, but until science can like, basically create a sperm and an egg out of absolutely nothing and make it create a human and then eventually a human race, then I'm still open to a lot of other conversations about what else is happening here.
And you know, when you hear about, or when I hear about string theory and the multiverse and, you know, all this sort of really anytime science opens the door to things unseen, to me, it sort of calls back to like, okay, well, perhaps early humankind was already in tune with some of these ideas and lacked the way to communicate it and the way that we communicate it now.
Or the other thing is like, I kind of think we're like devolving. You know, I think everybody's like, they think that because we have an iPhone in our pocket and we're technologically advanced, that we're actually evolving as a species, which I think is not true. And I would even say that like, although language has done some great things for us, there may have been a time where we were telepathic and language is just kind of like a really kind of like crude photocopy of what it used to be. You know, I mean that, and that's getting a little out there, but I don't know. I mean, I kind of feel like, and I was trying to get to here earlier where it just kind of seemed like psychedelics corroborated everything else that I was seeing and hearing about. And the more I learn now, after going through that kind of universal atheistic stage of doubt and questioning all this stuff that I'm reading, and, you know, I'd read the Bible, I'd read the Gita, I'd read some of this other stuff that's out there, you know, Buddhist philosophy. And it just kind of seemed like when I was on psychedelics, it was like, oh, it all makes sense.
I've heard this from people before, the geometric
stuff in the mosques, everything. It's like, oh, okay. I get it. All of these things are talking about the same thing. And one of them might be calling it soul. One of them might be calling it Surya. One of these other people over here might be calling it the sun, but we're all talking about the flaming ball in the middle of our universe, or the middle of our solar system. Sorry, that, you know, we're all talking about the same thing. It's just kind of represented in different ways, and maybe all these different kind of avatars of it. And of course, it gets distorted terribly by most religions, but. All these different avatars that people are seeing, just maybe is like the way it should represent itself and unfold itself to them. So for some, it might be some like machine elves. Other people, it might be Jesus on a cross. Other people might be like, I don't really want to deal with your representation of a white god. So they go with some blue Krishna, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now I'm just trailing off again.
No, I think you're in a great spot because it, and you know, and without falling into cliche, you know, we could certainly talk about how these ideas become, you know, codified and ritualized and so on and so forth and kind of start to lose their meaning as it's a copy of a copy. And I think you put it really, there's a great parallel with what you were talking about in terms of who knows how we once communicated versus how we communicate now. And by the same turn, you know, some of these ideas, these revelations or whatever you want to call them, practices, you know, how much does that stuff get distorted just in trying to explain it? Trying to explain the unexplainable.
You know, something like, you know, the Gita, for example, let's say we know that it was written maybe, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 years ago. And then you have to consider that it was probably spoken mouth to ear for like 2,000 to 5,000 years before that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then how much of it's changed or how much of it, like maybe the mouth to ear was like the better way of remembering it. You know, at what point does it start to get distorted or is it not distorted at all? You know, something like, you know,
Does it improve?
Does it get, you know, sharpened over time or, is it not distorted at all, but the further and further away we get from it, the more we're just like, that isn't true.
Right.
You know, but maybe it fucking was because, you know, sorry to curse, but, if you told me that 200 million years ago, which already is blowing my mind, 200 million years ago, there were these giant lizards that walked, I'd be like, you're full of shit. Fuck you. But. Yeah. Yeah. Lo and behold, it's fucking true. And, you know, so now I'm just like, I don't know shit about shit. Maybe humans did ride dinosaurs. I actually don't know.
I mean, this comes up,
that people are suppressing all the information anyway, because it doesn't fit the narrative. I mean, that's a current, you know, can't put that past anybody now.
This is a reoccurring theme on this podcast. And I think it's a big part of why having these conversations is so interesting for me and so fascinating is that I have come around, and people who've listened to this podcast a lot might be rolling their eyes and turning down their car stereo right now because they've heard me say it so many times, but I've come around to the idea that, certainty is kind of the death of faith for me. Like I'm so much more comfortable now in the mystery and in the unknown
certainty is not faith.
Right. And that was sort of like the Shelter album, right? Quest for Certainty. That was what my spiritual pursuit was all about for such a long time was, well, I got to solve the puzzle, right? I got to answer the riddle. I've got to figure out what everything's all about and then I'll know and then I'll be content. Right. And
but that's not true.
Now I'm finding contentment in the discontent. You know, sure.
I think being an adult and having that cognitive dissonance and being okay with it, just
being
like,
okay
it's
with
not,
it.
It's,
that's
it's
the
not
hardest
either
part.
Or it's both and,
yes,
you know, like you can't have a heaven without a hell. You can't have it. Well, this is getting a little deeper, but bear with me. And I'm going to name drop, like you brought up Shelter and Ray Capo or Raghunath. Like I'm totally down with most of what he's onto these days. Mm. And I think that he's really got it dialed in terms of like everybody in the West is into yoga. And you go to the yoga studio, you do a handstand, you have great abs, but you're still an asshole when you come off the mat. Like what's the point?
Yeah.
You're missing the point. Oh shit. I was going to say something else, about that. Yeah. We were talking about
the not either or, but
the both doubt. Yeah, maybe I'll come back around to it. Shit. What were you saying right before that?
What was I saying right before that? Certainty being the death of faith.
Yeah, shit. Maybe it's
content and the discontent.
Well, yeah, I mean, all of which are great points. I don't know. Maybe this is a dead end. I'll think of it later. I will say, though, getting back to... some of the stuff that Raghunath is promoting, or like some of the people that I've been turned on to through him, this guy, Radhanath Swami. I've been thinking a lot about, just to kind of maybe switch gears or something, but I've been thinking a lot about the idea that we have the engineering, whether it's social or technological, to fix most of, I think, what I conceive of as society's biggest problems, whether they be like global warming or identity politics or all of this other, you know. But I fear that we would just end up doing it again. We would just pollute everything again because we're not actually fixing the problem, which is like our personal disconnection from whatever we want to believe God is. Part of the problem is because we've pretty much killed God by killing religion, so we throw the baby out with the bathwater. You can hate Catholicism, but I still think that most people then just throw God away altogether, and that's kind of
course.
I'm starting to think a little foolish. You know, I'm very skeptical of where society is going and all the white noise. Like, I'm not saying that protesting and activism isn't important, but like, if we're not filling the God-shaped hole in our soul, then we're just talking about like details,
right?
And you know, so that's kind of disheartening for me, but also kind of relieving to be like, I feel like that's the solution. We need like a Martin Luther King or somebody like that to step up from like a faith perspective and lead these people, but it's just not happening because there really is no faith that anybody trusts. I don't know.
Yeah, and that was something that I came to, you know, because both of us, I think, came to radical politics and so forth. You know, we discovered a lot of that through punk music and subculture. And yeah, I was frustrated kind of early on by both the more sort of radical thinkers in that community, how they would toss the baby out with the bathwater and would seek to divorce the spiritual components of figures like Malcolm X or MLK. And then on the other side, as I kind of started to bridge the worlds between the super secular punk and hardcore and then the Christian hardcore stuff that was happening, a lot of those cats were coming from this very white bread evangelical right wing sort of world. And it would frustrate me how they would divorce their faith from radicalism, you know, from shaking things up, from, you know, the stuff that Jesus was actually talking about and doing contemporaneously. And so I always had this sort of odd incongruent fit where
You know, this makes me think of like I remember like growing up and hanging out with certain vegans and activists who would like, you know, protest fur places, and they were all about littering because they were like, well, maybe if everybody sees the place like so messed up, they will finally do something about it. Right. And like, they were legit, like they honestly thought this way. And I was just like, I mean, it was great because I'm still thinking about it. I'm still like rolling this over in my head, but like,
yeah,
what the, wow.
Yeah. Isn't it
the
crazy?
Lengths.
And then I also wonder as I've gotten older and as you said, you know, being humbled by things, you know, how much of my own identity did I then sort of champion, you know, seeing myself as like a badge of honor that I didn't quite fit in here and didn't quite fit in there.
Right.
Because, you know, I was always outsmarting whatever group I was around.
Right. Of course. It's like, I mean, that's always the thing is like you go into a fringe group because you're not accepted anywhere else. And all of a sudden you crave acceptance. And then all of a sudden that flips on its head.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, and then you interpret that through the lens of a band that like comes up through a scene, then hates the scene. Then it's like, no, we are, you know,
yep.
Don't kick us out. Where's our fans?
Absolutely. Yeah. Reminds me of, you know, doing my second cover story on Dashboard Confessional in 2002 and being told by his management and label at the time that I wasn't allowed to use the word emo in conversation.
Ooh.
And then, you know, 2020 and
letter words, Ryan.
Fast forward and he's playing Emo Night. You know, right. And that's not judgment call on him. That's more of an indictment of that cycle that we all go through.
I can, you know, personally flagellate myself for, you know, conversations with members of Dillinger about like, we're not math metal, but all of a sudden, exactly. Like seeing that in Wikipedia and just being like, wow, you know, would it really hurt to just carry the flag a little bit, you know, exactly. Or just like at least accept it, you know, not try to shoo it off so much. It's just like, okay, if you put the sticker on my bumper, I won't scrape it off.
Yeah, I had the, that's such a great, you're always great with the analogies. I love it. Yeah, it's just like, I have a friend who got hired to do some t-shirt designs for AFI a few years back. And he asked, you know, the person who hired him, was there any kind of direction from the band, anything I should do? And they were like, no, knock yourself out, you know, do whatever you think looks cool and you can submit it. But as far as don'ts, just don't do anything with pumpkins, bats, vampires, skulls, death, fire, blood, black, goth.
And do you know the Henry Ford advertisement? Have you ever heard this?
Uh-uh.
Like that, I think for the early Model Ts, the advertisement was something along the lines of you can have any color you want as long as it's black. That's so perfect.
I love it.
I use that all the time.
I love it. But yeah, this idea that we see artists go through where they become known and recognized and identified with a particular thing. And then there's books to be written about that, right? How you inevitably sort of resist the way you're being identified. And then at some point you come back around to, I mean, you know, it's
right. Well, that's the hero quest. That's the Joseph Campbell. The whole time it was right under my feet.
Yeah.
You know, or there's something about that.
Yeah. That's Death Magnetic, right?
Like, sure. Yeah. Well, one thing I'll kind of sort of wrap on.
As I unfortunately need to land the plane, but you're not,
yeah. It's,
this is the first of many, Liam. Well, Liam.
Sure, we can do this again. But you know, I feel like I need to drop it here because I've been thinking about it a lot, repeating it in other podcasts. So the same kind of like groan button for anybody who listens to podcasts that I do a lot, and I say this a lot, but probably more than anywhere else, I feel like it's relevant here. Where at least for me, I've been thinking a lot about the Anthony Bourdain, the Robin Williams or Chris Cornell, you know, or these people that like, at least from the outsider point of view, have like everything the material world could offer them at arm's length. They've had like the great, you know, like rise and fall. They've conquered addictions. They have like great careers. They kind of have the job everybody wants. They look great. They have beautiful partner. You know what I'm saying? I mean, the list.
Yeah.
On paper, everything looks beautiful, perfect, even. And you know that they could have anything they want for the most part. And yet they are still not satisfied at all, to the point where they're willing to end it. And then I take somebody like a George Harrison, who also had more than the world could offer him at an arm's length. You know, just literally the world is throwing itself at the guy. Mm-hmm. And he's also not satisfied and goes the, my sweet Lord, Hare Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where John kind of went peace, he went like even, he went deep. You know, and I'm super fascinated by artists who go through that spiritual phase, like the Dylan spiritual phase, and of course obviously like the Coltrane and Sun Ra and all that stuff too. But I've been really interested in it. Or like, you know, I've always loved 16 horsepower. You know, but just when all of it kind of dives in there, but just where that, you know, what is really going to fill that God-shaped hole, for lack of a better term. And again, I'm kind of stealing, you know, a Raghunath saying, which, you know, I'm not sure who he's borrowing it from either, but yeah, I've just been really stuck on that and trying to, you know, allow a little bit more faith or unexplainable stuff. You know, I'm not necessarily calling it coincidence anymore. I'm giving it a little bit more personality. I'm adopting more of a philosophy and a practice and like taking it more seriously. And maybe it's kind of like near death swipes that put me in this position, but I think I've always, and you can confirm, like I've always kind of been a seeker, and I feel like you too.
Absolutely.
At least theologically, you know, a lot of my decisions are, if you come back to this, whether it's good or bad, this foundation of values of like, you know, I don't know if that's a good idea. You know, even as reckless as I've been, it's, there's still that Catholic Jesuit, like, oh, God is watching.
And we've, yeah. And this is certainly, like I said, I'm pretty sure you were the first person I thought about having on this podcast when I came up with the whole idea. And it's because, yeah, we saw that same duality and struggle and flicker of faith and hope and curiosity and all that stuff. We recognize that in one another, I think, extremely early on. And that's continued to be one of our bonds.
To tie it back around to like, you know, the spiritual years of artists, not to mention, you know, Shelter and Extol and these other things that, you know, I'm sure you could name a bunch more, Me Without You.
Oh yeah.
You know, where these other worlds kind of intersect too.
Bad Brains, Cro-Mags.
Oh dude, of course. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, it's all, it's all wrapped in there for us. But yeah, you know, I'm honored to be able to have a conversation that lasts, you know, in perpetuity.
Yes.
In this digital form.
Indeed. And we're gonna do more. We're gonna do more. We got abbreviated. And normally I do feel like 45 minutes to an hour is the sweet spot, but we could comfortably do 3 hours.
Well, yeah, I realized that I've developed a bit of a monologue too, and I'm like, oh, can I spin this into 30 minutes without just sounding like we're never finishing talking about anything?
Well, to be continued, my friend. Thanks for doing this, and I'm going to be hitting you up pretty much immediately about doing it again. So
okay,
there's so much again. More.
I miss you.
Likewise, and, tons.
Hope you're well. And yeah,
I will never, ever, ever hear King Diamond and not think of you.
Oh. I take that as a compliment.
Oh yeah. I got to have him on. He's on the list too.
I may be able to, I don't know. I mean, you probably have connections too, but I have a sort of, my friend's cousin is married to him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's how I met him.
Oh, wow. He was the one time I interviewed him, which was years ago. It was for Metal Maniacs. And it was a phone interview. He was very excited to hear that I lived in Indiana because he's such a NASCAR Indy 500 guy.
Oh yeah. I
feel like I know. I'm like, dude, I want to talk about ghost stories. He wants to talk about race cars.
With that mustache.
Exactly. Those shades. Of course he loves.
Yeah, racing. Exactly. That totally makes sense now.
Well, I love you dearly. And we're going to do this again. As soon as I can wrangle you again, we're going to do it again.
Let's do it. You're a flower in God's garden, and I love you dearly. And thanks for having me on.
All right, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. See you later.